Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today, we're going to focus on Palestine. Towards the back end of the show, we'll be talking with the co-directors of a new film that I had a chance to see at Sundance when I was up there earlier in the year. And that film is called Five Broken Cameras, and it really digs into the resistance of a Palestinian village to a modern-day land seizure by the Zionist government and Israeli settlers. But before we get into that, I wanted to contextualize that. So I decided that I'd go back and talk to someone who's been deeply involved in and knowledgeable about the original land seizure of Palestine by Zionist forces backed up by various imperialist powers around the world, including, most essentially, the U.S. imperialists. That's what contextualizes the whole situation in Palestine today. The theft of the Palestinian land in order to establish the state of Israel. Now, to start things off, I'm going to read a few sentences from an article recently written by my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and director of the Palestine Land Society. In May 2012, Senator Mark Kirk made an astounding discovery, which had escaped scores of politicians, diplomats, and experts for six decades. He discovered that the number of Palestinian refugees is not 5 million, as United Nations Relief and Works Agency records show, but merely 30,000. The credit for this discovery goes to AIPAC and Israel, as they had advanced this so-called discovery for the last 4 months. Kirk took the signal and proposed a motion to Congress, which was passed after a mild amendment. Dispossessed Palestinians will remain dispossessed Palestinians with no recourse. Those are the words of my guest, Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine. Salman, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
Let's jump right into this. When I read your article, it was like sticking a pin in my eye. I paid a lot of attention to what's going on with the Palestinian people, and then seeing this just drove home again this whole question of the dispossession of the Palestinian people, and I wanted to talk with you about it. You make the point, you say it's impossible to examine the Palestinian land ownership in occupied Palestine outside the context of the general Palestine-Israel conflict. Can you explain what you mean there and why you say that?
The tragedy of Palestine is very clear. In 1948, Israeli forces, mainly composed of Jewish immigrants from Europe, took over Palestine by force, by military force. They have depopulated 675,000 villages within 6 months of 1948. Thus, we have the problem of refugees. The purpose of Zionism is threefold. Number one, to take over the land of Palestine. Two, to get rid of the people of Palestine by resettlement anywhere else except in their homes, is to erase their history and memory. And so we have in this case the largest, most comprehensive, meticulously executed ethnic cleansing in modern history. And this problem persists today. 64 years later, the Palestinians are unable to go back and live in their own homes. The land which is called Israel today, 93% of it is Palestinian owned, and this is the land of the refugees who are now scattered around Palestine and elsewhere.
Let's talk about this a little bit more, because you just made the statement that this, the expulsion of the Palestinian people, the seizure of the land, the theft of the land, was the largest planned, comprehensive, and still continuous ethnic cleansing operation in modern history. Can you get into that a little bit more? How did that play out?
In 1948, the Israeli forces occupied 78% of Palestine. In 1967, they occupied all of Palestine and parts of Syria and Sinai and later part of Lebanon. Now they still have 100% of Palestine and all Golan Heights in Syria. Now the whole world, through the international community, has declared that this is illegal under international law. The International Court of Justice has made a specific decree that the occupation of the West Bank by Israel, and indeed all of Palestine, is illegal under international law. There are more than 135 UN resolutions confirming or affirming the right of Palestinians to return to their homes, but Israel never complied with that, although it is a condition for its membership in the United Nations. Why it didn't do that? Because of the support of the United States through the Israel lobby in the United States.
Now, one of the things, though, it wasn't like they just walked in and started buying up the land, or they started just telling Palestinians, well, oh, sorry, but we own your house now. You got to get out. When you're talking about ethnic cleansing, you're talking about something that actually is a crime against humanity. It's actually something that the Nuremberg Tribunal basically said that this was a criminal act. And the Israelis were very, very, very vicious in the cleansing of Palestine. You refer to something in one of your pieces, you refer to something called the Green Patrol, which gave me a very sharp example of how they carried this out. Can you tell my listeners what the Green Patrol is and what it had to do with ethnic cleansing?
Before the Green Patrol, which started in 1950, in 1948, the Israelis carried out 31 military operations to take over 78% of Palestine. In each of these operations, at the beginning and in the middle, they have committed a massacre of a village, a total of about 77 atrocities and massacres. This was intended to propel the people and make them leave their homes. In fact, each village, the standard procedure was that each village was surrounded from three times, and the fourth side is left open for people to escape. They would kill a number of young men, and they take the rest to concentration camps where they were taken to forced labor camps. We have uncovered five visited by the Red Cross, and we have the documents in Geneva to prove it, but we have also uncovered 17 other forced labor camps through the testimony of the witnesses. Now, all this was carried out in 1948-49. If anyone tried to return home, they were shot and killed by the Israelis as being infiltrators. If you return to your home, you are an infiltrator. But the one who came from Europe through the shores of Palestine, infiltrated into the land of Palestine, is not considered to be an infiltrator. Now, after 1950, some Palestinians remained, very, very few, or almost 10 or 15%. When these people remained on their own land, the Israelis created something called Green Patrol, which went around and demolished their houses and actually put toxic material in their crops and killed their cattle in order to make them move. These were and are Israeli citizens. That happened after 1948, and these people were not refugees, but Israeli citizens. So this process, as you have said, is continuous until today. Today is going to be carried out not only inside Israel, in Al-Araqib, in Beersheba district, but also in Jerusalem and the West Bank.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because it plays out in these examples. For instance, one thing that we hear a lot about is the so-called Israeli settlers that move into the occupied territories and then claim them as their holy land, their promised land, and they get backed up by the military. And there's a constant confrontation with the Palestinian people who are saying, no, get out. Do you see this as a continuation of that same ethnic cleansing?
It is absolutely a continuation. It is done today through slightly different means. Instead of being military force in 1948 and 49, it's done now by subtle ways and not so subtle ways. Let us remember that the International Court of Justice in 2004 has clearly declared that the occupation of the West Bank is illegal under international law, and that means under the Rome Statute of 1998, which is the foundation of the International Criminal Court, declares clearly that the people of the occupier or the occupying force should not be settled on the occupied land. If they do, this is, of course, a crime against humanity, a crime against peace, and a war crime. Therefore, legally speaking, all the settlers in the West Bank are war criminals. And the Israelis deny that the West Bank is an occupied territory. They are the only people who claim that. Even the United States doesn't claim that. The whole world claims it is an occupied territory. So here you have not only the settlers taking Palestinian land in the land that was occupied in 1967, but also they take their water. 90% of the water of the West Bank is taken over by the Israelis, and they are left thirsty. Not only that, even South Africa did not dare to do that. They have Jews-only roads. If you are a Palestinian in the West Bank, you are not allowed to drive on roads allocated for Jews. When Bishop Desmond Tutu visited, he said, I know apartheid very well, but this is in the West Bank and Palestine. This is worse than apartheid.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Salman Abusita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, which is dedicated to the documentation of the land and people of Palestine. And we're talking about the ethnic cleansing that is a continuous thing going on in Palestine and the Zionist forces behind it from the very beginning. Now, Salman, you talked about this, the objectives of the Zionist master plan of ethnic cleansing, and you went through them, the land to conquer it, confiscate it, deny its original ownership, the people to kill them in massacres, expel them, chase them into exile or make their lives unbearable. There's also this thing about the identity and to erase any physical sign of the Palestinian presence, destruction of villages, monuments, holy sites, to change maps and delete Arabic names and replace them with Hebrew names and erase their mention in history and geography books. And I noticed that a lot of your writing really concentrates on trying to combat that. Why is this so important? Why did the Zionists go after this so hard?
Well, from the beginning of the 20th century, the Zionists have sold the European politicians, colonial politicians, the idea that Palestine is a land without people and the Jews are people without land, therefore let us get the two together. Now, this is a myth, and this myth was well known to the colonial powers themselves, the British and the French, because in the 19th century, they made surveys of Palestine, and they found, and we have all the maps today, they found that there are 1,000 towns and villages in Palestine, and some of them are actually recorded and known since the times of Jesus Christ. Now, why do they do that? Because they wanted to prove that they have not committed a sin or a crime against anybody. This is an empty territory. Now, we have to show that this is, of course, entirely false. So I worked for almost 20 years collecting documents from various European capitals, but mainly England and the United Nations and New York, Washington, in order to reconstruct the maps of Palestine, which has been erased by the Zionists. We have great difficulty because we are not yet a state, and I'm only a researcher, and therefore I have no authority to demand documents from government. But over 20 years, we have assembled the Atlas of Palestine, 1917 to 1960, 700 pages. It has the following. It has 1,600 towns and villages. It has 16,000 historical and religious monuments, and it has 26,000 place names. All these names, a total of about 50,000, are what I call the vocabulary of the social history of Palestine. It was not created by committee. It was created by the people in their course of life. For example, the Pigeon Valley, the Olive Fields, and so on and so forth. And this is, to me, a great testimony of the life of the people who have been rooted in Palestine for thousands of years. When Ben-Gurion was told that we have taken over Palestine and people will not accept it, he said, the young will forget and the old will die. Well, the old did die, but not before they tell their children about their patrimony, and the Atlas is a record of this patrimony.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of the Palestine Land Society, and we're talking about the dispossession of the land and people of Palestine. Now, Salman, we have a couple of questions left to ask, and one is, there's always the thing that the U.S. imperialists are always putting out to people and always putting out around the world, and the Israelis are right behind them and pumping it out. The only democratic regime in the entire Middle East, you know, whatever. The whole idea that the people who are living in Israel and in occupied Palestine, that they have recourse to legal rights. Yet, I'd ask you this. The situation, as you say, continues to be ethnic cleansing. What legal recourse do the Palestinian people have today in occupied Palestine, in what the Zionists call Israel?
You know, let me say this. Israel is the only racist country in the world today. There are many countries which practice racism in a subtle way and in a social way. But Israel is the only race country through its institutions and through its laws. There are 25 basic laws in Israel, at least, which discriminate against anyone who is not a Jew. Even though, and this applies to Jews who are not also citizens of Israel, they have the same rights like Jews who are in Israel. These basic laws discriminate against anybody who is not a Jew in the following manner: in the land ownership, in the land use, in education, in health, in employment, in family unity. If you are married to a Palestinian woman from the West Bank, you cannot bring your wife to Israel if you are Palestinian living there. But a Jew can bring an Australian or an American wife or anywhere from anywhere to Israel. The world has condemned Israel so many times in the Human Rights Council, and only last week, CERD, which is the Committee for Elimination of All Traces of Racism, has censored Israel very clearly about its practices. And this practice is continuing on today. You probably recall the case of a village called Araqib in Beersheba, and the Israeli government demolished the village for over 36 times. And this is obviously has been also condemned by European Parliament only last week. So Israel has the dubious distinction of being the most racist state in the world. The people in Europe and somewhat in America have, because of internet and television and so on, have really seen the reality behind the myth that Israel is democracy. 70% of people in Europe say that Israel is a danger to the world peace.
Let me ask you this, Salman. Real quick, you made a comment in a couple of your writings, in a couple of places, you made the comment that the Palestinians cannot depend on the Israeli legal system because Israeli law is the law of the conqueror. And it's designed to deprive the vanquished of their rights. And you also made a similar point around international law. Can you talk about that a little bit as the last question?
Yes. There is a simple adage which we can find somewhat useful here. I say, under the robber's law, you cannot retrieve the stolen goods. And this has been proven over and over again. But if you allow me, just let me say one thing before we go. There is now, by the Israeli lobby and Israeli supporters in the United States, a vicious campaign against UNRWA. Why is that? Because UNRWA is the last element of the international law about Palestine, which is in operation. And as in a typical crime, if you find the body of the victim, then there is a crime. So the Israeli supporters are trying to eliminate the body of the victim. And if there is no UNRWA, there is no refugees, and therefore there is no crime. And this, of course, is a vain hope because Palestinians are not only 5 as registered with the United Nations, but they are 7.4 million because some of them are not registered. And I have shown this in the Atlas because it's very simple exercise. The British have made a census in 1945, and we have the names of villages from which people were expelled, and we can know these villages and the population therefrom. And we can calculate that. It is found in one of my books called the Nakba Register. And the fact that they have stayed 64 years away from their homes and they have no intention of abandoning their right to go to their homes, which are very frequently a few miles away, then the peace can never come to the Middle East without the return of the refugees to their homes, which is a basic and fundamental human right.
Okay, Salman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, and keep up your work and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Salman Abu Sita, the founder and president of Palestine Land Society, a group dedicated to the documentation of the land and the people of Palestine. And I thought that I wanted to do this interview because I thought it was a very, very, very appropriate lead-in to the next segment, which is all about a new film that's out there that you'll get a chance to see. Look for it. It's called 5 Broken Cameras. And it's about a Palestinian village's resistance to a modern-day seizure of land by Zionist authorities. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss that. Welcome back. That was Dance of Drums from Mohammed Al-Hassan Abu Abid.
All right. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guests. And they are 2 filmmakers from Palestine and Israel. And they made a film I saw here at Sundance that just really knocked me back. This film is called 5 Broken Cameras. It's an incredible film, really important film, which I really, really liked. And I wanted to have a chance to talk with them. So got hold of them, and we're sitting here at the table, and we're about to talk about the film 5 Broken Cameras, and the filmmakers are Imad Bernat and Guy Davidi. Okay, guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi.
Imad, Why don't you tell people what the film's about?
The film is about my village, Bil'in. I live in a small village in the West Bank, and my village, since 2005, they started demonstration and they decided to struggle against the separation wall and the settlement construction. So I also decided to take part of this and to hand my camera and to document and to film the what's happened in the village and what's gonna happen. So during the last 7 years, I was documenting the struggle and the resistance and the direct action in my village and other events. At the same time, I was documenting my personal life, my family, and I was documenting my boy Jibril. He was born in the same time in 2005. So I was documenting him growing up with this, and he was watching what's happening in the village. So
let me ask you this. What does the title, Five Broken Cameras, have to do with the story?
The title, Five Broken Cameras, came from my five cameras. So during the last 7 years, five cameras was broken during the demonstration or the action in the village. So I lost my five broken cameras when I was documenting and filming the demonstration in the village. So each time my camera was broken, I tried to get another camera and to keep filming. So the story comes from these five broken cameras, and the title comes from the cameras.
Now, Guy, you don't live in the same village.
No.
Do any Israelis ever live in Palestine? I mean, aside from the settlers?
There was, I think, I know only one that, or two. And one is a journalist and one is Israeli-American. They are the only two, I think, that lived, that I know of.
How did you get involved in this film?
You're
a co-director?
Yes, we're both directors of the film. So in 2005, I got to Bil'in quite early in the beginning when the villagers started their movement against the separation fence. I was following up this movement in other villages, and when it started in Bil'in, we felt that it's going to be important there. So I came there. I was amazed by the hospitality of the people. I wanted to stay more. So I started making short films, and then very fast after starting making my first feature film that was shot as well in the village about another issue, not about the demonstration, actually, about the water, politics of water, which is another aspect of the occupation. So it gave me a good excuse to live in Bil'in for 2-3 months. And from that period, I think I got a lot of inspiration and a lot of understandings of what it means to live under occupation. And that was a very important experience. So, and in that period, I got to know also Imad. It wasn't very difficult to know him because he very fast he became an important figure of the village. He was the only cameraman that was part of the village. So it means that after demonstrations or after things, after other journalists or filmmakers left the village when the demonstration was over, he's the one left behind in the village. And when things got heat up, like soldiers entering in the middle of the night and arrests and settlers that burn up trees, like as we see in the film, he was the only one who could shot it. So he could shoot it. So he became an important figure with an important role in the village. So we knew each other. I remember in the 2-3 months I lived in Bil'in, it was kind of an intensive time because there were the night arrests just began, and during the nights they were always calling me and Imad to come out to film me, because at that period I was always also with the camera in the village for the film about the water. So you were going out to film these arrests, so I remember him side by side during the night. So it was another experience, early experience we had together. But we decided to make the film together out of the footage that Imad was shooting for years, only at 2009. Then Imad approached me, and it told me, well, Guy, I want to make a film. Let's do it together. And we decided working to create a film from years of footage and capturing more footage to finalize a film.
Now tell me this. So just so I understand this, were you mainly in the village originally, or and then you were part of a movement around? Were you involved? Were you an activist? You're mainly there as a filmmaker.
I'm an Israeli from Tel Aviv. You know, I don't like labels. I think people label too much. I came into Berlin because I wanted to support people.
Okay.
I came into when I participated in demonstration. It wasn't always with the camera. I wanted to support what was happening. I felt it's important. So in that sense, I am an activist, but I'm also a filmmaker. I was doing films from a very early age. So you know, it doesn't take time that I try to figure out what can I do with my camera, because this is what I do in life. So
yeah, that's, I just wanted to get straight on that, because I was unclear about whether you had been actually involved in this movement, mainly as supporting the Palestinian people. Or
of course I was. As an Israeli, I don't think I can feel good to just go with a camera and film and be in that role and that's it. When you go to support the people, you have to be there to support, to be engaged. I don't like that role of just holding the cameras and looking from outside. And I thought, as an Israeli, I have a bigger of an obligation. So, and it was hard for me because I'm regular in my life. I've the habit of being a bit of outside, to hold the camera and to be outside. So it's not easy for me to put the camera aside and to say, well, this is something that I have to do, which is not connected necessarily to a film. So I didn't go to Berlin to make a film. That came after.
Now, on the other hand, Ahmad, you were anything but on the outside with your camera. You were deep inside from the very beginning. And can you tell me a little bit about that? What is it that actually, give people a sense of what sparked off? You mentioned the separation fence, but it was more than just putting up a fence. There was something that fence did. I mean, what actually sparked the resistance of the people in your village? For years, you guys were, you know, you were farmed the land, you had olive trees, you had
all this stuff. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's for the village, for the people in the village, it's very important, the land and the olive trees. So the people love the land and they love the olive trees, and they survive of this land and of these trees. So when the Israel government decided to cut our land in the village and to build the wall and to build the settlement, so the people in the village, everybody was shocked because they would lose their land. It's a small village, it's not a big village, and they would lose 55% from the village. So the people decided to demonstrate and to say, no, we are not accept this. So we are going to demonstrate and to protest against this. But the people in the village, they decided to take the new way of resistance, the peaceful and the non-violent way. And it was important also, not just demonstration in the beginning, it was like everyday direct actions against the separation wall or against the settlement, peaceful direct action. So the people being joined by Israeli activists in that moment and by international who come from everywhere to support the village. So it became a big movement, and it became a new way to resist that. The media is also very important. We succeed in the village to bring the media to the village every day or every week. They were focusing in this small village and this is small idea. So it was big media in the village during the last 7 years. And when I picked my camera and I decided to film or to document, it's like was my decision was part of the resistance. So I wanted to film and I wanted to shoot. I wanted to document everything in the village, even after everybody leave. left the village. The activists or the cameramen or the press, I was there. I was documenting all the events. When the army came into the village in the night, in the day. So, and I used the footage in the beginning for the court approve and for to show the people the internet or to for the press who don't have footage. I gave him footage to show and this, and also to protect the people around me and to protect myself with the camera. Mm-hmm. So it was very important to have a camera in these events.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that comes out really, I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people who saw the film over the last few days, and one of the things that constantly comes out is people are just stunned by the criminal actions. I mean, and that's the only way you can explain it, you know, describe it, I think, at least that I can describe it, of the Israeli army. And this seeming, I mean, it's just amazing. It amazes people to see the settlers who are as fascistic as you can get, and then to see the army coming in. And the army shoots at a moment's notice, that without, you know, they just seem to open fire. Yeah. As routine. Is that part of daily life there? Was it during those years?
Yeah, this is our daily life in the village during the last 7 years. So it's the army can anytime can get in the village and patrol in the village, and so when they come to the village, I think they were looking for trouble. So they know they are kids and they can throw stone to them, so they start shooting with no reason sometimes. So I think it was different experience in the last 7 years in the village for everybody, for the women, or for the protesters, or for the children who live in the village. And I think the kids in the village, 7 years is long time. There are many kids, they were small and they grew up in this, in what's happened in the village. So they describe many things about the life. You don't need to explain for them how is the life. So they see what's mm-hmm. happened in the village.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one more thing, and then I'll move over to Guy for a minute, but one thing I think it's important for people to understand, when you mentioned the idea that you had worked the land and all this, that your people in the village had worked the land, what did it really mean? You know, think about it just from your heart. What did it mean when that fence came up, when the wall was going up? What does it mean, you said, you know, to lose 55% of your land? It's more than, you know, can you explain to people what that actually means, that fence would come up? And the way that they did this, I mean, the ripping up of olive trees that must have been there for, you know, how many years, you know, an entire village built around their tilling the land, and then all of a sudden, bam, sorry, not going to happen. Yeah. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, I mean, everybody in the village have his own land, and this land he can plant and he can survive this land, and he can in the future also he can use this land for to live for his boys, for the future of his boys, to construct a small house in this land and to live in this land. But when you lose this land, so you have no place, you have no other place to live. So the future of your kids or of your boys is lost. So there's no any place to go. It's a small village. So it's in the moment when you live, you survive with this land, and in the future when you lose this land, you have no other place to go. So it's very important for everybody in the village to have this land, this own land, and the people in the village, they love the land, they are connected to the land, they are connected to the olive trees, like when you are connected to your boy, you love him and you want to take care of him and you But who don't like the land or who don't care about the land, just he don't care. They destroyed and they uprooted the trees. So.
Now, Guy, I interviewed a man a long time ago. I fell in love with his music. His name was Gilad Asman. Are you familiar with him?
Yes, he's a jazz player, right?
Yeah. He used to be a major pop producer in Israel. And he was in the Israeli army. He got sent to Sabra and Shatila in the aftermath of Sabra and Shatila. And it completely changed his life. And he came back, and that's when he became a jazz musician. He was just like in this terrible funk, and he was trying to figure out how to, you know, where to go from here. And he told me at the time that it was very difficult. One of the things for him, it was very difficult in terms of him beginning to understand what the real character and the real nature of what the Israeli government was doing to the Palestinian people. And when he did, he felt, in his case, he felt obliged to leave. He stood up and declared himself. He said, I will never return to Israel. He lives in London now. He said, I'll never return to Israel until it's Palestine. And I'm curious about, in your case, was it difficult for you to actually, because I imagine there's a lot of pressure, and I know there's a movement that is sympathetic to the Palestinian people, but to make a film like this, which actually really exposes the kind of brutality that's visited upon people who are really, I mean, frankly, in the beginning of your film, you're doing nothing but living and you're arguing with your father about, you don't even want to work the land at a certain point, you know, because your father, what do you hit you in the head or something?
Yeah.
You know, and so there's this, but then the reality comes back when the land's being taken, when this event happens. For you, what does it mean, you know, what did it take for you to come into that, to do this, and did you suffer a lot of pressure from, you know, the Israeli society? Did you, you know, just what did it mean to do that?
When I grew up, I was a very stubborn guy. I mean, I knew as a kid, I knew what is right and what is wrong, and I didn't care to pay any price for that when I grew up. So when you grow up in an Israeli education system, you get a lot of propaganda and a lot of re-education. Militaristic education and Zionist education. So you develop many ideas regarding Palestinians, regarding Arabs. You're supposed to develop fear when you hear the Arabic language, for example. The occupied territories is like a shadow. It's a place where you don't go because it's dangerous and because there are people who are supposed to kill you. And the Israelis are, and the Jews are always in a threat. In every generation, there will be new people that will try to kill them. This is the mythology of Jews, not just because of the Holocaust. It goes way back. So you grow up with this kind of paranoia and with this kind of atmosphere that you have to be tough and even vicious in order to survive. Otherwise, I mean, it's either you are the victim or you're the victimizer, and there's no something else. And I wasn't, even as a young kid, I wasn't willing, I mean, intuitively. I didn't have political consciousness. I didn't have no idea what's going on in Palestine or... You know, it was just intuitively, I didn't want to be like that and to feel like that. These emotions were not the emotions I wanted to experience, so I had to confront with everyone around me. And so when the time came that I was supposed to go to the army, I didn't have yet any political consciousness, so I actually entered into the army, and I think it took me 2 or 3 days to be in complete shock. I mean, I think this was the most shocking period of my life. I discovered, in the most extreme way, where I'm living, where I chose to live. You know, I chose where I was born. Mm-hmm. You know, so I had a strong confrontation with that system, which included a strong confrontation with my family that was putting all the pressure for me to stay in the army, and the system, and people terrifying me, trying to tell me, if you don't go to the army, your life is going to be ruined. You have no future. No one will hire you. You cannot get a job. You won't have driving license. A lot of pressure. But as I said, I was a very stubborn. So once And something is, I felt something is not right for me and is not honest for me, I would fight it to the end. So it was a very traumatic time. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how this emotion, the Zionist emotion, is so powerful. I mean, the history of Judaism is. I'm not sure if many Palestinians understand how it enters into your body, and it takes big challenge and to be able to confront these emotions and these fears, and to be able to say, well, I'm not going to live like that anymore. So I left the army, I had some bad experiences. By the way, about filmmaking also, I enrolled into Tel Aviv University to study filmmaking, and I found that the university is a very depressing place, very oppressive place, because what happens in the military and in Israeli society towards Palestinian has impact in every field in Israeli society. So even if you go to study filmmaking, you're not in a safe place. You're affected by the brutality of people, by their violence, the way they criticize you, the way they won't help you or support you, the way politics will influence whether you'll be able to get budget to make a film or not. So I had to be independent, so I left university. So, and then after a while I discovered, well, I'm not able to make films in this country, so I left the country, like you told me Gilad Atzmon did. And after leaving the country, I discovered that I have some things I have to do here in Israel. So it was, I think, when I decided to come back after just 1 year I spent in Paris, I said to myself, if I'm coming back to live in Israel, I want to confront all the shadows of this society, and I want to open up this ghetto, because we live in ghetto in Israel. So I think one of the first thing, even in the first week when I came back from Paris after I left, I immediately went to the West Bank. So that was so for me to the period in 2005 when I came to Berlin and stayed there for 2-3 months was very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're talking with the filmmakers, the directors of the film Five Broken Cameras, Imad Bernat and Guy Davidi. And we're talking about life in Palestine, and in particular in this village. And the village is Belin?
Belin.
And what happened there when the Israelis decided to erect a separation fence and then a wall, right? So now, tell me this, Imad. The story of the attack on your village, it took a terrible toll on your family. I mean, it seemed like your family, one after another, was ending up, you know, it was like each scene, somebody else was being hauled off to jail.
Yeah, this is, I think, my family was also part of this the resistance in the village. So this is one of the reasons who made me make the film. Because since the beginning of the, since 2005, my brother, my first brother was arrested, and my second brother was arrested, and my third brother. And you can see my father and my mother trying to stop the jeep and take out my brother from the jeep. So this resistance affected me and affected my family and affected my brothers and my friends and my boys. So in the same time, it's affected everybody in the village, not my family, but it's this became more close to me and more personal. So it was the decision was is first I was confused about to make a film personal, but then I wanted to make it not very personal, but when we meet I and Guy, he pushed me and he convinced me to make it more personal, because personal, when you show the personal life under this situation, under what's happening in the village and how we deal with this, and you show the personal life and the resisting in the village, it's more touch and more powerful. So the people can know how is the life there and how the people live, not just to talk about conflict and about wars and about the Israelis and Palestinians and about people get killed and how kilometers is the wall or how many lands take the wall. So it's you have to get in the personal life to show more.
Again, let me say that we're talking with the filmmakers Imad Bernat and Guy Davidi, and we're talking about their new film, Five Broken Cameras, which tells the story of a Palestinian village under assault by the Israeli military and government and the attempt to erect a separation wall, which will devastate the life of the Palestinian people in that village. Now, one quick question. In the middle of all this, Gaza, the assault on Gaza in 2008, 2009 happened. It comes up in your film. What was the impact of that? Because that was, I mean, as the world watched, that was a terrible, terrible crime that got committed. And here you are in the West Bank, and then you see this assault on you, and you're living under this constant military assault yourselves, and then you see what was happening in Gaza. How did that impact the villagers, you guys, and your struggle?
Yeah, the impact is very strong for everybody when Gaza is the same. We are the same people and the same area. So it's very strong impact for the people in the West Bank or the village to know and to hear bad news about what's happening in Gaza. People get killed every day. And if it's like a real war. But what's happening in the village, you don't feel it's a resistance, it's a struggle of the people, but it's not a real war. So the village is supposed to support Gaza by this resistance in the village and to do something to support Gaza by demonstrating in Friday and saying something or... It's just to make a protest or a demonstration special for Gaza, to support Gaza. So they what can do in this time. And this time I was in the hospital which when the war in Gaza started. And it was actually was my after my accident in the wall. So for me it was I was bad injury and I was. All my family and all my friends in the village, they was talking about my life, and so they told me after this, the bad news, I was supposed to die. So they were waiting for this, and in the same time when I survived and I was in the hospital, I heard about Gaza in the news and the violence in Gaza, the war, people got killed. So it's. So I forget myself, and I was thinking what's going on in Gaza, like everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, Imad, you were hospitalized in the same hospital and in the same department of the famous doctor who lost four of his kids. It's the same hospital, well, yeah. So yeah. I don't know if you met him.
Yeah, no, I didn't meet him because I was in... I couldn't go out from my room, so I couldn't walk. So it was.
That's an important connection.
So, yeah. So I was watching the helicopter from the window in the first night war in Gaza, coming to the hospital, helicopter bringing people or I don't know soldiers or people or. Mm-hmm. So I. It was fear and scared that something big going to happen.
Now, in a little bit of time we have remaining, I want you to speak to that too, Guy. What impact did Operation Cast Lead, the attack on Gaza, have on you? As you're in the village, you're working with the Palestinian people, you're helping to film all this. What impact did that have on you?
At that time, during the Gaza war, it was very, very tough time for Israeli society. I mean, in a bad way, because every one of us, the left radical, and peace activist that had tried to show kind of different voice or to act out was shut. Even just regular people told us, you know, this is a wartime, you shouldn't criticize, you shouldn't speak, you shouldn't publish, you shouldn't talk on anyone. I was actually doing two films at the same time. I was shooting in different places. I was running from one place to another to just capture moments. And the feeling was that Israeli society is just they won't confront with what's happening. And everyone we're speaking about the people of Sderot and how they suffer, and we are not allowed to speak, to say anything, because the people of Sderot are suffering. And actually, I always say that there is a very strong peace movement from Sderot of people that say, don't do this war in the name of Sderot. We don't need the war. What you're creating in Gaza is going to come back at us for years after. But for people, for them, this is a wartime, and we shouldn't. Everybody should shut. The media in general was completely ignoring of what was happening in Gaza. There was a war of media, so it was a very, very bad atmosphere, very bad moment. All the people, my friends that are peace activists, they felt traumatized from that. My girlfriend wanted to leave the country, and I was in a demonstration filming for a short film on demonstration in Tel Aviv. We were basically 2,000 people. These are the people that are objected to war, not much more. And to these 2,000 people that were demonstrating in Tel Aviv against the war came 1,000 of right-wing demonstrators to confront us. And they were shouting at us that we were traitors. And, there was a feeling that at every moment a grenade can be thrown at us. And throughout the last 10 years, I think that was a very hard moment that we felt how much we are isolated. And at the same time, it was very hard to go back to Berlin and to these villages. It was important for us to be with them and to participate, but at the same time, it was tough for us because, 1,600 people died, and there is kind of expectation of us to do something, to change something, and we're not powerless, but we're still a minority.
Yeah, and it raises a fundamental question about what the hell is going to be done there. One last thing, just what do you hope the people get from the film? Each of you can say. So, Imad, what do you hope people get from your 5 broken cameras and now your 6th camera? What do you hope people get from this?
Yeah, I hope I know the people here in the United States or in other countries, they know a little about Palestine and about Israel, and they just see the news and the footage in the news. They don't know the reality of the life, the people life there in the West Bank or in my village. So I hope that the film reach more and more than people, and we can change something in this world.
Okay. Guy?
I would like to address even more directly to the Jewish community in the United States specifically, because I think a lot of people feel that they have to support in Israel in any case because of history and because a lot of idealization and about their Zionism and for many, many reasons, whether they are justified or not, it doesn't matter. But as an Israeli that lives in Israel, I would like to address them to stop thinking that supporting the Israeli government is supporting Israelis. Supporting Israelis is to help us to heal from our wounds and from our fears. And in order to heal from our fears, to do that we have to confront our shadows, and we have to fix these relations with Palestinians to create justice in the region. And to create this justice, it seems to me that we have to confront the politics of Israel. And so by confronting these politics and confronting the government of Israel, at the moment you're helping Israel to shape it and to create different, because we need that support. People are not, I would add, people are not aware that how much influence the Jewish community has on Israeli politics. And I think Jews took a very certain role throughout the history, and we need them to rethink of things and to try to understand that they can be constructive by criticizing what's happening in our part of the world.
We've been talking with the directors of the film 5 Broken Cameras, Imad Bernat and Guy Davidi, and a really, I think, don't hesitate to see this film when you get the chance, because it raises lots of questions and it really makes you think a couple times about very important issues in the world in different ways. So thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up the show for this week. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And leave you with this thought from Bob Avakian and his book Basics. After the Holocaust, the worst thing to happen to Jewish people was the state of Israel. Think about that one for a little bit after what you learned today. We're going to go out now with Everlast, Stone in My Hand.
Every son that suffers, every mother cries. So if you had enough and are ready for your stand, I'll be waiting with a stone that's in my hand.